More voices.
Welcome to Animal Voices. It was said that every creature deserves to live a life in that promised Garden of Eden. The chickens, the turkeys, the pigs and cows, all of them have a right to live their lives free from cruelty, free from the harsh conditions that factory farming imposes on these wonderful members of the animal kingdom. Fortunately, there is a growing consensus that factory farming and concentrated animal feeding operations are indeed morally wrong. Fortunately, there are alternatives, including eating a vegan diet or buying animal products only from producers who allow their animals to go outside and live a minimally decent life. Values are changing. There is a growing awareness that our consumption and gift-giving should be cruelty-free. In this program, Animal Voices, we envision a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom. In many of our Animal Voices programs, we offer a glimpse into a world that has systematically been hidden from the public view. How political. Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRA 102.7 FM, is a co-op radio, is a non-commercial, cooperatively owned, listener-supported community radio station. Located in the heart of downtown Eastside, co-op radio is a voice for the voiceless that strives to provide space for underrepresented and marginalized communities. Alan Jensen, thank you for being our technician. My name is Carl Loskin, and we have also in the studio today co-host Marge Adams. Marge Adams, what will you be doing today?
Well, first of all, I want to talk about the rabbit cull that's going on in Kelowna and causing a lot of interest throughout not only the province but the world. So that's a pretty big happening. And then in the second part, I'm going to keep my interviewee undercover for the present time.
Undercover guy is coming in. Well, and we may be listening to Ingrid Newkirk giving us a presentation about Be Kind, Be Kind. Ingrid Newkirk, she's the founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Well, I have a couple of announcements as well. There will be a 2008 Artists for Animals charity auction this coming Saturday, the 4th of October at St. Patrick's Hall, 2881 Main Street, Vancouver. It's a silent auction, and it's from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Some wonderful pictures, and you can have a look at the website, www.kensingtonfoundation.ca. Wonderful pictures that are going up on auction, mostly, many of them animal-related. So there's also a wonderful documentary film I saw at the Vancouver International Film Festival yesterday. It's called Fierce Light, Fierce Light. And it's a documentary about activism and spirituality. And tonight is the opening of the movie called by Bill Maher. He's a vegan. Vegan Bill Maher, and it's going to mainstream theaters, and it was also shown at the Vancouver International Film Festival. It's called Religious, Religious. So there we have it. Now, you know, since we'll be doing something with our secret guest, he wanted to have a quote from a person who was very close to us here at Animal Voices when we got Animal Voices started. It was Lindsay Bickford, a great technician, loved technical things, electrician, and he used to have a quote that he used to say, "On the crude flesh of beasts they fed alone, savage their nature, and their hearts of stone." Thank you, Lindsay. So over to you, Marge. And we love rabbits.
Yes, thank you. I think there are a lot of rabbit lovers out there. As some of you are no doubt aware, the city of Kelowna has a very large population of rabbits running around freely, and there's a bit of a problem with this. The city decided in their wisdom that they would hire a company to cull the bunnies. Now, this led to further difficulties. Last Saturday, a security guard, a woman named Gwenda Garrett, witnessed a rabbit being shot with an air gun, falling to the ground and flopping around, half dead, I suppose one might say. After this went on for a time, the shooter came out and a second person and walked over to the injured animal and stomped it to death. Now this Gwenda Garrett found very upsetting, and she reported the incident to the police, and they are currently investigating it, the latest I've heard. Now, this issue has become a hot-button political issue. The mayor of Kelowna feels she's been put in the middle and is not happy about that because she never did support the action in the first place. Now, once the police have completed their evaluation, the council will be making a further opinion. In the meantime, council has received 500 emails at the last count that I was able to get, and letters from citizens complaining about the cull. What has happened is that PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, has put a note on their action alert page, and they don't know how many people have responded and actually written to the council, but they do know that they have had over 1,000 hits on that one action alert, so that people are very concerned. Now, the person at the Parks Board, who is the manager for the city of Kelowna, has this to say: we've been getting some pretty angry emails from people, not just local residents, but from animal rights groups. Some of the groups are pretty extreme and known for drastic actions, but so far we've just been getting a lot of emails. At the same time, we are hearing concern from orchardists who are worried about the impact of the animals on their livelihood. So the council is really kind of between the devil and the deep blue sea at this point, I guess. But he says the stomping incident was appalling, and the city is reviewing the cull methods the contractor will be able to use and hopes to have new methods in place by next week. PETA, of course, wants them to have a humane killing method, and one they suggested was injection of barbiturates. And there was a second possibility as well, capturing and releasing. But we know that does not always happen. It works. But PETA admits that sometimes you have to euthanize animals, which is kind of sad to hear. But nevertheless, I guess it does happen. So that's all I wanted to say about that, Carl. But I'm glad to see that PETA has stepped in, and I'm glad to see that so many people, I think it's encouraging to know that so many people are concerned about rabbit and the cruelty to animals. I think that's growing all the time, that concern.
Well, thank you, Marge. And now I was wondering whether you could, if people are curious to know who your very special guest is today. So maybe you can introduce him. Over to you, Marge.
I certainly will, Carol. My very special guest, by popular demand, is Carl Loskin. And Carl and I have known each other now for 8 years. I'll tell you how I met him. Well, he was out to resurrect the Animal Voices radio show on Co-op Radio, which had been defunct for a year or two. Alan could probably tell us how long, but it was a while anyway. And so what Carl did was contact several local volunteer groups and ask them to send representatives to meet at a local vegetarian restaurant. Of course, knowing Carl, it had to be a vegetarian restaurant. And what happened was that four of us met, not unbeknownst to each other at that time. Carl was representing Earth Save Canada. John Pranger was Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection. And Lindsay Bickford, a graduate electrical engineer from McGill University, he came and volunteered to be our technician, and myself, Marge Adams, from Vancouver Humane Society. Well, what happened was we decided to unite forces and present a proposal to Co-op Radio. Sure enough, it was accepted. I guess we were probably an influential group, I guess. And soon, Carl, John, and I became co-hosts, and Lindsay, our producer and technician, and a very good one, Lindsay was. Now, Carl has been the driving force, I have to admit that, on Animal Voices ever since. And for the last 3 years, Carl has produced an Animal Voices film festival. I just want you to know that he is a driving force filled with ideas and blessed with the energy to carry them out. So he's been a really great, extremely important part of this program in the last 8 years. Now, I know that some of you are curious to know something about Carl, and so I want to ask him a few questions, and he's agreed that he will answer to the best of his ability. I'll tell you first of all, the thing that would impress anybody when they first meet Carl is his height. He's 6'5". He's slim, so that he looks 6'5" or more. I guessed him to be 6'7", frankly. He used to have dark, rather wavy hair. He still has hair, not as much, and it's fading in color, I'll say. So, Carl, wonderful to have you on the show today.
Yes, Marge, it's unusual to be interviewed rather than be the interviewer.
I bet.
And I sometimes meet people who are taller than me, and I find it quite intimidating.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
You have to look
They're
up.
Looking down on me.
Well, you know how the rest of us feel then. We're about 5 foot something. Yeah.
Speak to me while I sit down.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Carl, I know we mostly all know from your accent where you were born, but maybe you could start by telling us about your early years.
Yes, my parents were both immigrants to South Africa from Germany, and I was born there right so when the war began, 7 days after the Second World War started. My father was called to the police station, and he was interned for 7 years till 1947. So the war was over in 1945. So then it was a very difficult time for my mother. My parents had just started a hairdressing business in Port Elizabeth, and my parents never learned to say Elizabeth. Of course, they always said Elizabeth. So we lived in Port Elizabeth, and then after the war, we moved to Paarl and then to Cape Town.
Uh-huh. Now, was your father just interned because he was from Germany? Did they do that to all the Germans?
They did it pretty much to all the German citizens, and my father used to tongue-in-cheek say, well, when in their business they didn't put out when it was the Queen and King George came to visit, he didn't put out the Union Jack and in the store.
Oh,
so
oh.
He said, that's why they locked us up. But they did it to most of the Germans, much like they did to Japanese in Canada.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And tell us about your education in South Africa, will you?
Yeah. We went to in Paarl, we went to an Afrikaans school, Dutch Reformed mostly. And then we went to a private Catholic school in 1950. And I was raised as my parents were both Catholic, Roman Catholic. And then I went to university, studied commerce, and I'm a failed. I was articled to a firm of chartered accountants, and I wrote the final exams 3 times, and I heroically failed it three times, because imagine in what kind of ivory tower I might have sat if I had passed those exams.
Oh, it was a blessing that you did.
Very lucky that you failed this.
Think of how dull it would be in chartered accounting.
We were auditors. It was quite exciting, and I studied law and commerce and statistics and subjects like that.
And did you enjoy that?
I did, yeah. Imagine. It was really exciting. Because at the same time, mm-hmm. I was more involved with the University of Cape Town Yacht Club than with my studies.
Oh, I see. Okay. And now you were brought up a Catholic. Are you still in that religion?
I'm not a practicing Roman Catholic. In fact, I view organized religion with some distance. And of course, when one looks at how many of these religions came into being, mm-hmm. it's not a pretty story. And you know, when I traveled in South America and saw how the plundering in the name of the faith and how it continues to this day in many ways, mm-hmm. because in many parts of the world it's still fundamentalism at work, and it's such incredible ties with political issues, and we see that over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I had to tell my, when we grew up at school, and my twin brother, yes, I have a twin brother, his name is Wolfgang, mm-hmm. and we attended the same Catholic, we went to the same masses, the same catechisms, the same everything. And somebody once asked me, says, how comes your brother, oh, he's a wonderful guy, he is such a devout and wonderful Catholic, and you seem to be what they consider as a very derogatory name, it's called a lapse Catholic.
Okay.
So I said, no, actually, it's quite willful. It's a decision which I've made. It's not because I don't want to become involved in religion. Mm. I consider myself to be a collapsed Catholic.
You do, okay.
So you have but I believe that spirituality supersedes all organized religion and is a part of all organized religion as well, and has a wonderful contributing force of love and kindness, mm-hmm. but I won't be involved in it.
Yeah, I see. Now, you gave up chartered accountancy, and what did you go into as a vocation? You were still in South Africa at that time, I guess, weren't you?
I worked for a company of shippers as a vocation, is it?
Yeah.
What your job was. Yeah, I worked for a company of shippers. We had offices to Tokyo, London, Zurich, New York, and we were importing. They started the trade with Japan after the Second World War. They had a company that had 600 employees in Osaka, and everything in those days was done with a telex. Such a different system, and it was the company owned canning factories in South Africa, uh-huh. and I was doing the costing for the canning factories.
And that got you
daily
interested
costing.
In seeing the world, I'll bet, didn't it?
Sure.
Yeah. So you came to Vancouver.
I came to Vancouver. I spent a year traveling Europe and the Middle East. I was in a kibbutz for quite a while in Israel, and then. It was my intention to come to Canada. Even though I speak Dutch, I speak German fluently, of course. Mm-hmm. I was offered jobs in London and Amsterdam, and of course my cousins in Germany said, this is a wonderful country here. You must come and stay here.
Sure.
But I said, no, I think I'm going to Vancouver and British Columbia. They have a big wide ocean there. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That British Columbia alone is three mm-hmm. times the size of Germany, and I really like the open spaces. Plus, you know what I see about Germany here? There's too many rules everywhere here. This is everywhere I see it on the lawns. Es ist nicht gestattet. Es ist nicht gestattet dies, es ist nicht gestattet das. That means you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. So I in 1967, I did my immigration and came to Canada in January 1968.
Did you have a job to come to, or friends here, or something else?
No, you know, and which of course is a wonderful perception is I don't know anybody here. I'd only met many Canadians in Europe, and I thought they were all wonderful people. Mm-hmm. And so my aunt in Germany, she said to me once, she said, "How comes?" This was many years later when I went to visit her. She said, "How comes you ended up in Vancouver? Did you know anybody there?" I said, "No." "Did you?" And she knew I didn't have any. Did you have any job prospects over there?" I said, "No." She says, "Aber das kann ich gar nicht verstehen. I mean, I can absolutely not understand that." And then there was a big silence. I didn't know what to say. And then she thought for a while and she said, "Oh, but your father emigrated to South Africa. And your mother's parents emigrated to South Africa. Maybe it's in your blood."
Okay. You accepted that, I guess.
Sure. I loved her, my Tante Maria.
Yeah, and you eventually went to one of the islands.
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. I had a business in the United States, and during the time of the Vietnam War, I became so disillusioned with the whole political upset, the violence that we saw, bloodshed and death and mutilation that we saw day for day on the screens during the Vietnam War.
Where were you in the U.S. at that time?
In Seattle. I actually started the trade with China. When Nixon freed the trade with China in 1972 and became legal to import goods from the People's Republic of China, I was at the Blaine border that very day with a truckload of goods from the People's Republic of China, including rugs. And I drove up with my truck, my van, and the guy said to me, he says, "What do we have here?" I said very cheekily, I said, "Goods from the People's Republic of China." And he said, "Go over there." And they phoned Washington, D.C.
Oh,
and it had been permitted. Can you imagine that in this day and age now, where almost everything comes from China, that it was illegal to even have anything in the United States that was manufactured in the People's Republic of China?
My mother had a shop in Park Royal, a gift shop. And she sold stuff from Scandinavia, but also from Japan and China in her shop. And until that time you're talking about, whenever tourists would come into the shop, she'd have to tell the American tourists that you can't take this back to the States with you. It's so bizarre that until that time, a tourist could not buy something in a shop in Vancouver and take it down into the States. It was from China. It was such an embargo. It's amazing to think of. Because, as you're saying, Carl, it's completely the opposite now. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe overboard we've gone now. So you asked me about going to De Courcy Island. Mm-hmm. It was out of a sense of deep disillusionment with what the world was going through. There was the Iran crisis, and we certainly believed that the world and the Western countries needed to free themselves from the dependence on Middle Eastern oil. I mean, that was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And we were speaking out about that. Uh-huh. And how true it is today. Why did we have to wait 40 years? So it was a deep sense of disillusionment with the world. Mm-hmm. And I actually believed, which I'm quite honest to admit my own errors of thinking, is that I believed that the economic world would collapse. Now, I also see that that I was wrong to have said it at that time, but merely that my timing is out.
Right, yeah, quite. So what year was that now, in the early 60s?
I sold the business in 1974. And I decided I was never ever going to work again. Bought a few properties, and that's it. Freedom from having to work for a living.
Yeah.
At the age of 35.
Interesting, yeah.
But it was also based on minimalist living, because when I moved to De Courcy Island, there was only one other person living there. I bought the smallest boat because there was no public transport to the island. And we were going to do a self-survival thing there. That's what I was going to do. I had 5 acres there. And and it was there was a revolution taking against the, maybe Alan, you spoke of that time in 1975, which was also the year when co-op radio started. There was a many good things started.
Yeah, it's an amazing time to if you reflect on it, what was going on in Vancouver, many other places as well, but in the early 70s, and it kind of 1975 is a key, a seminal point, kind of. Many organizations kind of got their start just around that time, like Co-op Radio and like CCEC Credit Union in the east side of Vancouver, the Vancouver Food Co-op, which is still going on Commercial Drive, and Spartacus Books, like all these organizations and many others started around the same time. Obviously, a lot of them have disappeared now, a lot of these organizations that sprung up in the early and mid-70s, but there's still quite a few left. But it says something very interesting about the times, and this I see this is coming out of the 1960s, and all the energy from the 60s and the counterculture in the 60s, and a lot of people who were involved in things in the 60s and the 70s started to look at things in more practical terms, to get together to form cooperatives and or associations of different type and get organizations happening so they could do something practical, have an alternative economy, so to speak, to what they saw around them, and so mm-hmm. it kind of slowly coalesced out of the 60s, mm-hmm. and it's interesting that Carl, you're talking about your change in attitude towards things around the same time. Lots of people were reflecting on things at that time. I know myself. I went back to university in 1976. After having dropped out in the 60s. And like, it was just what one did, right?
Yeah,
dropped out in the 60s.
And inhaled.
I actually quit the university in fourth year, right? Before graduating, I thought, no, I'm going to get out of this. And 10 years later, a little less than 10 years later, I decided to go back to university in 76, and which was a very interesting time to be there. Because the Vietnam War that Carl was talking about was causing all these changes.
Now, the Vietnam War was over
It had ended by then.
It had ended by 76. Yeah, I see. Why did you quit in fourth year, though? I mean, that is highly impractical, I must say.
I was not concerned with practical things, you know. There was other things in the world, right?
Yeah.
Other interesting stuff. I ended up doing a lot of other things. I went to India for a while and traveled around and just got involved in other sorts of things other than academia.
Did you have money in your pocket to be able to travel?
Well, not a lot. I mean, I had a summer job that I'd had in university in a fish cannery, which actually paid fairly good money.
Okay.
And I was able to save quite a bit to take off. And that's in the 60s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when I went back to university, I had to work in the post office for a couple of years in Toronto to make enough money to go back. And that time, the post office paid very well.
Uh-huh.
And you could work a lot of overtime. So I was able to save money and go back to university in 76.
Oh, yeah, and only for a year, that would be all, and you would have your...
No, I went for 5 years.
Okay,
and that money I'd saved in the post office?
So you got
I got some scholarships and things as well to keep me going, right?
Yeah.
There was lots of money for universities at that time. There's a difference between then and now and as well. The government of Canada, and this is Pierre Trudeau, and his government put a lot of money into the economy for social programs, for young people to do things, and so on, and into universities. And there was a lot of money in the universities at that time, so there was lots of scholarships. And it's a very different world then than now.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I don't know. I think we're ready for the 60s all over again.
Here, yeah. Anyway, so we've just left Carl in the Courcy Island.
Yes.
So
now, you were very active on the Courcy Island, weren't you, with anti-Vietnam efforts and anti-nuclear?
Anti-nuclear. We walked the streets, and with me was my friend Joseph Roberts, who started publishing the Common Ground magazine. What a wonderful person he was, uh-huh. and always trying to get the people together. And also, you know, we really felt that capitalism was on. You know, I looked at some of the Karl Marx books, mm-hmm. and I always just tell people about how everybody criticized Karl Marx. So I tell them this story. It's about Karl Marx's mother. And so Karl Marx's mother said, if only Karl had made some money instead of writing about money, it would have been much better. But you know, Karl Marx was so ahead of his time. He spoke about what we have as a international dilemma right now, and that is the control of the world economy and the world political situation by small groups and extremely powerful corporations who have agenda of their own. And we know also from EcoShock, if you listen to that program, it's not to the environmental agenda, and it's not often what is in the interests of the people. Otherwise, we would not have had so many wars. It seems as if some economies in the world thrive on wars. That is a statistic which is undeniable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, especially if, with our neighbor to the south, I think it can be pointed out over and over again.
Talk about that and just mention the same thing, that the military-industrial complex and the American economy. I think the Americans themselves don't really appreciate the degree to which their economy is based on military production, and there's a problem, because once you're geared up for military production, it's hard to change, right? You've got hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people, millions, I'm sure, working in military industries, and all these politicians whose ride, you know, whose constituencies are controlled by military businesses and so on, so they all vote in favor of military stuff, and it's a very, very difficult thing to imagine changing. It's a huge problem when you allow that to evolve. I mean, we all know that, like Eisenhower talked about that. That's Eisenhower's phrase, that the military-industrial complex, and he saw it actually happening and growing, and it's since his time, though, that it has really, you know, become the dominant, by far the dominant part of the American economy, and it's a really serious problem if your economy is based on that, because you have to keep looking for wars, right, or starting
creating them to use up all this
military stuff, right? You have to drop a few bombs so you can make new ones, right?
Sure. And, of course, you get a lot of support for your campaigning running for office from the military-industrial complex. Now, you'd mentioned Joseph Roberts as a person who was very influential. Now, what other people have been influential?
Well, I've been an avid reader to this day. Thanks. I'm an avid newspaper reader. And so there were some books that really were pivotal in my change of attitude. And one of them was Survival into the 21st Century. It was called A Planetary Healer's Manual. It was a kind of big book. And, in 1976, we never envisioned that we would be surviving in the year 2000. You know, wow, that was so far away, you know.
Yeah.
Cannot conceive of it. Right, Alan?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
And so what was in this this book, The Planetary Healers? Well, it's going to take a few chapters here. Well, there was Anne Wigmore talking about wheatgrass. There was a passage on breatharianism. That's getting energy from breath. Sunshine. It's called Sunshine for Lunch.
Oh, really?
And then Fasting, Not Starving. And also a miniature indoor greenhouse garden growing, and live food vegetarian diet, and also there was
that must be
this was a book that really
publication date, I'm wondering.
Anyway, it was one of the books we really moved to. So it also set forth this attitude now, which we're involved with now, is of course the plight of the animals. But there was other books too that really were very significant to me. We'll go on to somewhat religion. Was Teilhard de Chardin. He was a Jesuit priest whose books were only published posthumously. And he wrote a book called The Phenomenon of Man. And as you can see from this book, it looks like it's maybe from the 18th century.
It's well worn, I have to say.
It's been carried. Yeah. But what is the significance of Teilhard de Chardin for me? It was that he spoke about the world in an evolutionary process. He spoke about the world in its context as a part of the universe. And there was a wonderful quote, I tried to find it this morning, but I'll say it as best as I can from memory. And remember, he was a Jesuit priest, mm-hmm. philosopher, and he said, if ever you think you are important, if ever you think you have done something wonderful in the world mm-hmm. and have a sense of achievement, he suggests that one starry night you step out and look at the stars and contemplate the enormity of the cosmos, and he says, who wouldn't but be humbled by that overwhelming experience.
Overwhelming. I know exactly what he means.
Teilhard de Chardin. We'll go to the next book, Jean-Paul Sartre, and of course, you spoke about Camus. Yes, I read all those Camus books, but Jean-Paul Sartre was a very significant book in my thoughts on existentialism. And it was about, he exposes his theories about doing and being. So I don't know if you want to go too much into that, because he wrote the trilogy
about
existentialism. But
you may have other books there, but I think John Robbins was an influential person in your life.
Yes,
right?
It
like
is.
He
came to Vancouver and in 1986, and he had written the book called Diet for a New America, and he spoke about his experiences with relating the world with Gandhi. And the two principles of Gandhi, which was ahimsa, which was compassion towards all living things, mm-hmm. and the other principle, satyagraha, which is the Indian word, Mahatma Gandhi, which is non-retaliation. And there's many people find those principles unpractical. But you know what? Nelson Mandela, whom I so admire, he espoused those theories. And when he wrote about Gandhi in the year 2000 as the most remarkable person on the planet Earth, I knew that that when Nelson Mandela was released from Robben Island after having been imprisoned for 27 years by the apartheid regime, that Nelson Mandela, in fact, practiced the principles of non-retaliation when he said publicly, I feel no animosity towards the people who kept me on Robben Island for 27 years.
Amazing, isn't it? Yes, I remember that. Yeah, very impressive. So, but John Robbins, now we were mentioning, Earth Save Canada. I want to hear about
Earth Save Canada. Well, mm-hmm. I became involved with Earth Save Canada through Diana Jewell, because Earth Save Canada immediately started a public speaking program called, it was called Earth Save Toastmasters. Toastmasters group is a communications and leadership program where we can speak about anything that is of interest to you. Well, you know, Lindsay Bickford, whom we quoted right in the beginning, he used to make videos of everybody's speeches and give us the video. We would watch it, and we would learn so much from our presentations. Toastmasters is a communications and leadership program, but since it was Earth Save, it had an environmental touch to it. Earth Save this past week had a wonderful celebration, Taste of Health. I think some 5,000 people came to that that celebration. I was one of the highlights of my life was when we started the first Taste of Health vegetarian festival. It's not called vegetarian festival; it's called a food festival. But we had notable speakers there. Howard Lyman came to Vancouver, and he said, "No animal has to die for me to live." And they had the bookshelves, they had food, and people were eating vegan foods. And don't forget that 10 years ago, the word vegan was not in existence. There was no such word. So we learned public speaking, and then after we'd been doing this with Lindsay at the Toastmasters for about 6 years, he said, there must be something bigger than that. And there was this program on animal on Co-op Radio, and we always listened to the Brown Bagger anyway. And so the rest is history, and you already spoke about that, how we applied for the program. But, you know, our first program was rejected. Now, even though my policy in life is, if at first you don't succeed, give up, you're not suitable to do it, we did try it again. And then we changed the program, we submitted to the programming committee, and within a week we had a program. Wow, now we had to talk. And we've been going for 8 years.
It's been wonderful.
9 years.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, really, really exciting to be on the radio. We've done it for a long time now. I guess it's becoming a regular expectation every week. But now I want to bring in the current events right now, the party politics that are going on, and I want to know what you consider important issues in this election.
To me, there are two issues. Basically, is the war. I mean, I just don't understand it. It's totally beyond me. And the other issue is the issue, the greatest liberation which I feel lies ahead of us, and that's the liberation of some 10 billion factory-farmed animals that live in absolutely excruciating situations, their lifelong. And they're treated as commodities. We need to inform our politicians that these kindred species need to be liberated from human cruelty.
Well, that is an extremely big item to deal with. I have not heard anything mentioned yet in the federal election about the other species. And how would you suggest we go about getting it on their agenda?
Well, we need to go to political parties' meetings. We need to write letters to the media. And we are part of the media. We know how it works. You know, it's Howard Lyman always just say, you know how the media works? It's the golden rule. Them that have the gold, make it the rules. But you know what? Co-op Radio, the alternative internet, and the many of the publications and books and people whom we've had on Animal Voices, Tom Regan, so many people. I'd like to just mention a few people, organizations that are close to my heart. Of course, we've mentioned Earth Safe Canada. Vancouver Humane Society has done tremendous work. There's Liberation BC with Joanne Chang and Glenn Gatz. There is the Workless Party with Conrad Schmidt and many principles which I adhere to, is that we should be, the Workless Party says we'll work less, we'll earn less, we'll consume less, and that should be, and we'll spend more time on the cultures and the article and enjoying life and walks in the park. And I totally agree with the Workless Party. Conrad Schmidt wrote a book called Workers of the World Relax. The other organization that I'm close to is Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, CETFA. They're doing investigations, financing investigations into slaughterhouse practices and the auctions, and we're slowly making progress. We lobby the political the Food Inspection Agency, and SETFA.com. It's a great organization. And also I'm on the board of Save Our Shores, and North Vancouver organization to preserve the public areas on our North Vancouver shorefront. And I'm on the board of Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society.
You often so, write letters.
I do. The Animal Defense and John Pranger and Ann Berthasel, great people who are inspiring us. Kelly Bunting with the Animal Voices Film Festival, just wonderful people. All these people, there are no whales in captivity. You know, all these...
there's a lot of really honorable...
What I see is that we need to work together. All these organizations have different agendas. We respect each one's different agenda, but we ultimately... it's the same. We need to improve the lot of the animals.
Absolutely. Now, I know we must be getting towards the end of our time.
No, we
here.
Have.
Are we?
Is
oh, we've
that
got
okay?
loads of time.
We have lots of time.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's a question for you, Carl. Is Canada democratic?
Well, I believe the so-called democratic system needs a somewhat tweaking to make it more democratic, because what we have is like even in the provincial politics, we had a political group winning 46% of the public vote and had a majority in the House of Parliament, and I think we need to have a system which Alan will better explain with
proportional representative system is what you're talking about, the proportional representative, and in fact that was brought up in the leadership debate. Elizabeth May brought it up clearly. That's a Green Party plank. To change the electoral system in Canada. So it is a proportional representative system of some sort. Like, it has been talked about a lot in British Columbia, and in fact there's going to be a referendum next year in British Columbia about changing the system. The provincial government was pushed into this, and Campbell had to go along with this. Remember, they set up this commission and this panel, and they went all around the province and talked to people, and they came up with a proposal. Now, unfortunately, in a way, the proposal they came up with is a bit unwieldy and complicated. At least, it's not a simple proportional representative system like you find in many European countries. It's a slightly different system. And it's harder for people to get their heads around it. I'm afraid that's going to mean that it's going to be difficult to pass it. If they'd come out with a proposal for just a straightforward proportional representative system like they have in Germany and many other countries in Europe, it might have had a good chance of passing. But we'll see what happens. As the election gets closer, there'll be a lot of publicity around it. But it was interesting, nonetheless, last night in the debate to hear Elizabeth May championing this idea on a federal level, because clearly it's true. Probably in this upcoming elections, the Conservatives, if they get as little as 40% of the vote, could get a majority in the House. 40% of the people in Canada vote for the Conservatives. They'll get a majority. And, of course, not everybody votes. So when you get down to it, the people who actually vote are, only half of the people vote anyway. So 20% of the population will vote for the Conservatives, and they could get a majority. There's something clearly wrong with that picture.
It was a single transferable vote, wasn't
it? That's right. That's the proposal, exactly. That's coming up.
And it seemed beastly complicated. I studied it
at
the time.
Same here. And you have to look at it and look at it again and spend some time. And most people just clearly don't have a sense of it. Whereas, like I said, if you just presented them with a straight PR type system, then you might have a chance of them, and then you could go from there to a more complex system. But anyway, that's where it is now.
There are several countries do have this.
All kinds of countries have it. Probably half the countries in the world have it. Like we're way behind with this British system inherited with an appointed Senate and with a Parliament that is a first past the post Parliament. Mm-hmm. Clearly we're 200 years behind.
Marge, you asked me about democracy and of course this is an attitude which I find pervasive with people who've been entrusted with representing us, is that they often consider the public to be outsiders. You know, they often, once they're in power, I mean, now they're listening to us. And that's why it's so important to speak about the animals and to speak about the war. But once they're in power, there comes this arrogance. And I've seen that with the government that's in power right now, that they consider the public to be ignorant and not worthy of making the decisions which they've been entrusted to. That basically that the people and the opposition are uninformed. And in so doing, they manipulate politics. And, you know, and I see this with the present government, minority government in power in Ottawa, that they were saturating advertising on many of the TV channels. And this was the message that came from the Conservatives. It says that they were the only ones to manage the finances of the country, and they kept repeating it in so many ways, much like the Big Mac adverts, so that with this political saturation advertising, people actually begin to believe it.
Absolutely. That's what is called the big lie, right?
Yep.
That is the big lie.
And it does work. You got the money for the advertising. You can convince people of almost anything. Now, let's see if we can finish up on a positive note in this interview. Animal issues. Now, tell us, are they getting more attention? Are things moving ahead? Or what's your feeling on that?
Yes, I think we have to. Yes and no, of course. Now, get back to democracy, where we know that a survey of the people is. Are our political representatives speaking for us? We know that I think it was like 90% of all the people who were asked about the whether factory farming was morally justifiable, 95% of the people said, no, it's morally unjust. Yet, we have this situation where a bill passed through the legislature and it was watered down. It was presented a half a dozen times under a different number. And by the time it went through, it was meaningless. It has to be reworked. So the people who are able to represent the factory farmers, which are often companies based in Taiwan and don't forget that Bill Clinton's one of his biggest supporters was at the Tyson Group, which was based in Arkansas, financed his election campaign. But we have made tremendous strides. So, because look at all the organizations. You can go to almost any restaurant and you'll find that if you ask for a vegan meal, you'll get it. Look at the emphasis of where even the health practitioners are saying, eat more fruits, vegetables, nuts and grains, whole grains. Not refined grains. And when last did you hear anybody say, eat more meat, chicken or fish?
Kim just phoned in, and we don't have much time left, so I didn't put her on the air, but she had a question. Kim is one of the people who help on our program here. She's not here this week. Anyway, she just had a question for you, Carl, about the Green Party and asking you how you feel about the Green Party as their policies and whether it's something you could support.
Well, it's certainly by watching Elizabeth May last night, it's sad that the left is so fractioned. That we have the NDP, we have the Liberals, you have the Greens, and basically, if you put all their consensus together, you have a majority of people. Yet, if we're fortunate, we'll probably be saddled with a conservative government. Now, is my vote to vote for the Green Party a wasted vote? No, I don't believe it's a voice to divide. I'm making a statement with the Green Party because they espouse the theories. She spoke out against the unjust war and the unjust Canadian involvement in Afghanistan and the deception that goes with it, making the public think that we're involved with building schools and building hospitals, where in fact the statistics show that only $1 out of every 20 is actually going towards that, and that most of the money is going towards a combative action. We're involved with the drones, all kinds of high-tech spin-off. I'm against it. Elizabeth May spoke up about it. And also, at the last election where this government came in, some 600,000 people voted for the Green Party. If, in fact, a proper STV democratic system was in place, the Green Party would have had at least two or three members of parliament. That's what we're striving for. We want the environmental agenda to be on the menu. We want people in our political spectrum to listen to the animal issues. It's enormous. 10 billion animals are slaughtered for their flesh and raised in the most inhumane conditions, and that's why I'm here speaking out for them that cannot speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Carl. Well, any other question, Alan?
We've got a couple of minutes left, and I just thought I'd, in terms of what you were just saying, there are a whole bunch of elections coming, not where you live, Carl, but over where we live in the city here. There's a provincial election coming up on the 29th of October. There are two by-elections in my riding. Is there one in your riding? Marge?
A by-election? No, I don't
okay.
think it's a by-election.
Because two MLAs have quit. Like in my riding, Lorne Mancourt quit.
Yeah, right.
The ghastly thought. I thought when he quit that he was going to get out of politics. Now he's running for the federal party for the Conservatives. Not surprisingly, he's running for the Conservatives in the riding I'm in for the federal election. Mm-hmm. But that has left the provincial seat open.
Okay.
So there's a by-election on the 29th of October, and of course we have the civic election coming up in Vancouver, as well as the federal election, so it's kind of electoral season.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in North Vancouver you must be having civic elections also, Carl, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Right,
yeah. Do you see anything, is there an active party in North Vancouver that you can support? Like in Vancouver, we do have a progressive civic party. Is there such a thing in North Van?
I've been focusing mostly on the federal issue here and the upcoming provincial. I'm not sure when the municipal elections are. It's been so overpowered by the other elections,
including the United States elections. Which isn't ours, but the news is full of it. So we're just surrounded by election talk, right? We're in this
right.
sea of... Anyway, we have to wrap it up.
I'm going to close off with one idea from the Vancouver International Film Festival and Fierce Light. That is just an incredible documentary done by people from Vancouver about spirituality and activism. And the most moving moment for me was when, I think this Butterfly Hill, when she had been spent 2 years in this gigantic redwood cedar, and she spent 2 years in a tree. And when she came down and touched Mother Earth, and I was so overwhelmed.
Really?
I was so, it's a real tearjerker. It was a real movement because I thought of Betty Croswick, who's running for the mayor of Vancouver. So thank you for listening to Animal Voices. Our webpage is animalvoices.org.
I want to tell you a story.
Creepings. Because the rest of the votes are going to be split up amongst all those other parties. And it's a terrible thought to think that if only 40...